2 hours later, a green and yellow service truck bounced along the field road and maneuvered itself close to the disabled tractor. Two servicemen slowly got out, inspected the hot sun and cloudless sky, then walked around the tractor for an initial look. They reluctantly opened up the panels of the service truck and began removing tools and wrenches. The sun baked them, and they were soon sweating. To make the day somewhat more pleasant, they turned on the radio in their truck and cranked up the volume. Merle Haggard could be heard wafting across the soybean field. The music muffled the crack of a distant rifle shot. It hit Mo Teal directly in the upper back, ripped through his lungs, and tore a hole in his chest as it exited. Teal's partner, Red, said over and over that the only thing he heard was a fierce grunt just a second or two before Mo fell under the front axle. He thought at first that something from the tractor had snapped loose in a violent way and injured Mo. Red dragged him to the truck and raced away, much more concerned about his buddy than what might have injured him. At the equipment shed, the farm manager called an ambulance, but it was too late. Mo Teal died there, on the concrete floor of a small dusty office. Mr. John Deere, we'd called him during the trial. Middle of the front row. Bad body language. At the time of his death, he was wearing the same type of bright yellow uniform shirt he'd worn every day of the trial. It made for an easy target. I saw him at a distance through the open door. Sheriff McNatt allowed us inside the shed with the now standard prohibition against taking photos. Wiley had left his cameras in his pickup. Once again, Wiley had been monitoring the police scanner when the report came across.
"Got a shooting at Ned Ray Zook's farm."
Wiley was always near his scanner, and in those days he wasn't alone. Given the high state of anxiety in the county, every scanner was being listened to, and every possible shooting was reason to hop in the pickup and go for a look. McNatt soon asked us to leave. His men found the cans of oil that had been drained by the vandal, and they found a window that had been pried open for entry into the shed. They would dust for fingerprints and find none. They would look for footprints on the gravel flooring and find none. They would scour the woods around the soybean field and find no sign of the killer. In the dirt beside the tractor, they did find the .30-06 shell, and it was quickly matched with the one that killed Lenny Farguson. I hung around the sheriff's office until well after dark. As expected, it was a busy place, with deputies and constables loitering about, comparing stories, creating new details. The phones rang nonstop, and there was a new wrinkle. Random townsfolk, unable to control their curiosity, began stopping by and asking anyone who would listen if there was anything new. There was not. McNatt barricaded himself in his office with his top boys and tried to decide what to do next. His priority was the protection of the surviving 8 jurors. 3 were already dead. Mr. Fred Bilroy, of pneumonia, and now Lenny Farguson and Mo Teal. One juror had moved to Florida 2 years after the trial. At that moment, each of the 8 had a patrol car parked very near their front doors. I left and went to the office to work, but I was sidetracked by the lights at Harry Rex's. He was in his conference room, knee-deep in depositions and files and all sorts of lawyerly debris, the sight of which always gave me an instant headache. We grabbed 2 beers out of his small office refrigerator and went for a drive. In a working-class section of town known as Coventry, we drove along a narrow street and past a house with cars parked like fallen dominoes in the front yard.
"That's where Maxine Root lives," he said. "She was on the jury."
I vaguely remembered Mrs. Root. Her small red brick house had no front porch to speak of, so her neighbors were scattered around the carport in folding lawn chairs. Rifles were visible. Every light in the house was on. A patrol car was parked by the mailbox, 2 deputies leaning on its hood, smoking cigarettes, and watching us very closely as we drove by. Harry Rex stopped and said,
"Evening, Troy,"
to one of the deputies.
"Hey, Harry Rex," Troy said, taking a step toward us.
"Quite a party they got going, huh?"
"It'd take a fool to start trouble around here."
"We're just passing by," Harry Rex said.
"Better keep moving," Troy said. "They got itchy fingers."
"Take care."
We eased away and drove to the Hocut house. We found some bourbon and sat on a front porch, swatting an occasional mosquito and trying to appreciate the situation.
"He's very patient," Harry Rex said. Wait a few days when all these neighbors get tired, when everybody relaxes a little. The jurors can't live long locked inside their homes. He'll wait.
One chilling little fact that had not been released was a service call received by the tractor dealership a week earlier. At the Anderson farm south of town, a tractor had been disabled under similar circumstances. Mo Teal, who was one of four chief mechanics, had not been sent to repair it. Someone else's yellow shirt had been watched through the scope of a hunting rifle. He's patient and meticulous, I agreed. 11 days had passed between the two murders, and no clues had been left behind. If it was indeed Danny Padgett, there was a stark contrast between his first murder, Rhoda Castlelaw, and his last two. He'd advanced from a brutal crime of passion to cold-blooded executions. Perhaps that's what 9 years in prison had taught him. He'd had plenty of time to remember the faces of the 12 people who'd sent him away and to plan his revenge.
"He's not finished," Harry Rex said.
One murder might be considered a random act. Two meant there was a pattern. The third would send a small army of cops and vigilantes on to Padgett Island for an all-out war.
"He'll wait," Harry Rex said. "Probably for a long time."
"I'm thinking about selling the paper, Harry Rex," I said. He took a long drink of bourbon, then said,
"Why would you do that?"
"Money. This company in Georgia is making a serious offer."
"How much?"
"A lot. More than I ever dreamed of. I wouldn't work for a long time. Maybe never." The idea of not working hit him hard. His daily routine was 10 hours of nonstop chaos with some very emotional and high-strung divorce clients. He often worked nights when the office was quiet and he could think. He made a comfortable living, but he certainly scraped for every penny.
"How long have you had the paper?" he asked.
9 years.
"Kinda hard to imagine the paper without you."
"Maybe that's a reason to sell it. I don't want to be another Wilson Caudle."
"What will you do?"
"Take a break, travel, see the world, find a nice lady, marry her, get her pregnant, have some kids. This is a big house."
"So you wouldn't move away?"
"To where? This is home." Another long sip, then,
"I don't know. Let me sleep on it."
With that, he walked off the porch and drove away. With the bodies piling up, it was inevitable the story would attract more attention than the Times could give it. The next morning, a reporter I knew from the Memphis paper arrived in my office, and about 20 minutes later, one from the Jackson paper joined us. Both covered northern Mississippi, where the hottest news was usually a factory explosion or another indicted county official. I gave them the background on both murders, the Padgett parole and the fear that had gripped the county. We were not competitors. They wrote for large dailies that barely overlapped. Most of my subscribers also took either the Memphis or Jackson papers. The Tupelo Daily was also popular. And frankly, I was losing interest. Not in the current crisis, but in journalism as a vocation. The world was calling me. As I sat there drinking coffee and trading stories with those two veterans, both of whom were older than me, each of whom earned about $40,000 a year, I found it hard to believe that I could walk away right then with $1 million. It was difficult to stay focused. They eventually left to pursue their own angles. A few minutes later, Sam called with a rather urgent, "You need to come over." A ragtag little unit was guarding the Ruffin porch. All four were bleary-eyed and in need of sleep. Sam cleared me through the bivouac, and we went to the kitchen table where Miss Callie was shelling butter beans. She gave me a warm smile and the standard bear hug, but she was a troubled woman.
"In here," she said.
Sam nodded, and we followed her into her small bedroom. She closed the door behind us as if intruders were lurking, then she disappeared into a narrow closet. We waited awkwardly while she rattled around in there. She finally emerged with an old spiral notebook, one that had obviously been well hidden.
"Something doesn't make sense," she said, as she sat on the edge of the bed.
Sam sat beside her, and I backed into an old rocker. She was flipping through the pages of her handwritten notes.
"Here it is," she said. "We gave our solemn promises that we would never talk about what happened in the jury room," she said. but this is too important not to tell. When we found Mr. Paget guilty, the vote was quick and unanimous. But when we came to the issue of the death penalty, there was some opposition to it. I certainly didn't want to send anyone to die, but I had promised to follow the law. Things got very heated. There were sharp words, even some accusations and threats. Not a pleasant thing to sit through. When the battle lines became clear, there were three people opposed to the death penalty, and they were not about to change their minds. She showed me a page in her notebook. In her clear and distinctive handwriting, there were two columns. One had 9 names, the other had only 3. L. Farguson, Mo Teal, and Maxine Root. I gawked at the names, thinking that maybe I was looking at the killer's list. "When did you write this?" I asked. "I kept notes during the trial," she said. "Do you think some of the other jurors have come forward with this same information?" Sam asked me. "Maybe, but it was a long time ago, and I doubt if they kept notes." Sheriff McNatt was out making the rounds, visiting each juror. I had to unload on someone, so I barged into Harry Rex's office and waited impatiently while he finished a deposition. When we were alone, I told him about Miss Callie's list and the division of the jurors. As usual, he had the most cynical possible theory.
"Those three were supposed to hang the jury on guilt," he said after a quick analysis. "They caved for some reason, probably thought they were doing the right thing by keeping him out of the gas chamber. But of course, Paget ain't thinking that way. For 9 years, he's been pissed because his 3 stooges didn't hang the jury. He figures he'll get them first, then go after the rest."
"There's no way Lenny Farguson was a stooge for Danny Paget," I argued.
"Just because he's crippled?"
"Just because he was a very devout Christian."
"He was unemployed, Willie. He was once able to work, but he knew his condition would only deteriorate over the years. Maybe he needed money. Hell, everybody needs money. The Pagets have trucks full of cash."
"I don't buy it," I said.
"It makes more sense than anything else. What are you saying? Somebody else is picking off the jurors?"
No, it's Paget, and it just so happens that the first 2 he picked off happened to be 2 of the 3 who voted no to the death penalty. He doesn't know how the vote went. He was in Parchman 12 hours after the verdict. He's made his list. Farguson was first because he was such an easy target. Teal was second because Paget could choose the setting."
Harry Rex's phone had never stopped ringing. He glared at it, then said,
"I got work to do."
"Okay. I guess I'll go see the sheriff. See you later."
I was out of his office when he yelled,
"Say, Willie, one other thing."
I turned to face him.
"Sell it. Take the money. Go play for a while. You've earned it."
"Thanks.
But don't leave Clanton, you hear?"
"I won't."
The former juror called Earl Urey called the sheriff and said he had important information. He admitted his recollection was less than thorough, but he was certain that the crippled boy and Mo Teal had been adamant in their refusal to impose the death penalty. He remembered that they had a 3rd vote. Maybe it was one of the women. Maybe the colored lady. He just couldn't recall exactly, and after all, it had been 9 years. When I walked into the sheriff's office, he had just finished his conversation with Mr. Urey, and he was as bewildered as he should have been. I closed the door and relayed my conversation with Miss Callie.
"I saw her note, Sheriff," I said. "The 3rd vote was Maxine Root."
For an hour we looked at it from every angle. McNatt did not believe that the Pagets had bought or intimidated either Lenny or Mo Teal. He wasn't so sure about Maxine Root since she came from a rougher family. He more or less agreed with me that the first 2 killings had been coincidental, and that Paget, in all likelihood, did not know how the jurors had voted. But both of us conceded. With Lucian Wilbanks involved, it was entirely possible Paget knew more about the deliberations than we did. Anything was possible, and nothing made sense. While I was sitting in his office, he called Maxine Root. She worked as a bookkeeper at the shoe factory north of town and had insisted on going to work. McNatt had been in her office that morning inspecting the place, talking with her boss and co-workers, making sure everyone felt safe.
Two of his deputies were outside the building, watching for trouble and waiting to haul Maxine back home at quitting time. They chatted on the phone like old friends for a few minutes. Then McNatt said, "Say, Maxine, I know that you and Mo Teal and the Ferguson boy were the only three who voted against the death penalty for Danny Padgett." He paused as she interrupted. "Well, it's not important how I found out. What's important here is that makes me real nervous about your safety. Extra nervous." He listened to her for a few minutes. As she rambled on, he interrupted occasionally with such things as, "Well, Maxine, I can't just charge out there and arrest the boy." And, "You tell your brothers to keep those guns in their trucks." And, "I'm working on the case, Maxine, and when I get enough evidence, I'll get a warrant for his arrest." And, "It's too late to give him the death penalty, Maxine. You did what you thought was right at the time." She was crying when the conversation ended. "Poor thing," McNatt said. "Her nerves are shot to hell." "Can't really blame her," I said. "I'm ducking under windows myself." The funeral for Mo Teal was held at the Willow Road Methodist Church, number 36 on my list, and one of my favorites. It was barely in the city limits of Clanton, south of the square. Because I had never met Mr. Teal, I did not go to his funeral. However, there were many in attendance who had never met him. Had he died of a heart attack at the age of 51, it would have been sudden and tragic, and his final service would have drawn an impressive crowd. But being gunned down in a revenge killing by a freshly paroled murderer was simply too much for the curious to resist. The mob included long-forgotten high school acquaintances of Mr. Teal's four adult children, and meddling old widows who seldom missed a good funeral, and out-of-town reporters and several gentlemen whose only contact with Mo was the fact that they owned John Deere tractors. I stayed away and worked on his obituary. His oldest son had been kind enough to stop by the office and give me the details. He was 33. Mo and his wife jump-started their family, and he sold new Fords over in Tupelo. He stayed for almost 2 hours and desperately wanted me to assure him that Danny Padgett was about to be hauled in and stoned. Interment was at the Clanton Cemetery. The funeral procession stretched for blocks and for good measure swung by the square and proceeded down Jackson Avenue, just outside the Times. It did not disrupt traffic at all. Everyone was at the funeral. Using Harry Rex as an intermediary, Lucian Wilbanks arranged a meeting with Sheriff McNatt. I was specifically mentioned by Lucian and specifically not invited. Didn't matter. Harry Rex took notes and told me everything, with the understanding that nothing would get printed. Also present in Lucian's office was Rufus Buckley, the district attorney who had succeeded Ernie Gaddis in 1975. Buckley was a publicity hog who, though reluctant to meddle in Padgett's parole, was now anxious to lead the mob to lynch him. Harry Rex despised Buckley, and the feelings were mutual. Lucian despised him too, but then Lucian disliked virtually everyone because everyone certainly disliked him. Sheriff McNatt hated Lucian, tolerated Harry Rex, and was forced to work the same side of the street with Buckley, though he loathed him in private. Given those conflicting sentiments, I was quite pleased not to be invited to the meeting. Lucian began by saying that he had talked with both Danny Padgett and his father, Gil. Not surprisingly, Danny denied any involvement in the murders of Lenny Ferguson and Mo Teal. He was shocked by what was happening and angry that he was widely considered to be the chief suspect. Lucian presented airtight alibis for both murders, though his small audience was very skeptical. Of course the Pagets would deny everything, and given their capacity to lie, break legs, and bribe with serious cash, they could find witnesses for anything. Sheriff McNatt voiced his skepticism. He explained to Lucian that his investigation was continuing, and if and when he had probable cause, he would get his arrest warrant and descend upon the island. He had spoken several times with the state police, and if 100 troopers were necessary to flush out Danny, then so be it. Lucian said that would not be necessary. If a valid arrest warrant was obtained, he would do his best to bring the boy in himself. "And if there's another killing," McNatt said, "this place will erupt. You'll have 1,000 rednecks crossing the bridge and shooting every Padgett they can find." In the 9 years since I'd bought the Times, I had never left it for more than 4 days. It went to press every Tuesday, was published every Wednesday, and by every Thursday of my life I was facing a formidable deadline. One reason for its success was the fact that I wrote so much about so many in a town where so little happened. Each edition had 36 pages, subtracting 5 for classifieds, 3 for legals, and about 6 for advertisements. I was faced each week with the task of filling approximately 22 pages with local news. I was tired of writing. 20 pages a week, 52 weeks a year. I woke up each morning thinking of either a new story or a new angle for an old one. Any bit of news or any unusual event was inspiration to puff up a piece and stick it somewhere in the paper. I wrote about dogs, antique trucks, a legendary tornado, a haunted house, a missing pony, Civil War treasure, the legend of a headless slave, a rabid skunk, and all the usual stuff, court proceedings, elections, crime, new businesses, bankrupt businesses, new characters in town. I was tired of writing, and I was tired of Clanton. With some reluctance, the town had come to accept me, especially when it became obvious I wasn't leaving. But it was a very small place, and at times I felt suffocated. Clanton was changing, and I was not happy with its direction. Like most small towns in the South, it was sprawling in all directions with no plan for its growth. Downtown was declining, though the courthouse and the county government would always draw people. Strong political leaders were needed, folks with vision, and they were in short supply. On the other hand, I suspected the town was weary of me. As the paper grew and the profits increased, and as a direct result my skin got thicker, I editorialized more and more. I railed against closed meetings held by the city council and the county board of supervisors. I sued to get access to public records. I ridiculed the state's campaign finance laws, which were designed to allow rich people to elect their favorites. And when Danny Padgett was set free, I unloaded on the parole system. Throughout the 70s, I was always on a soapbox, and while this made for interesting reading and sold papers, it also transformed me into something of an oddity. I was viewed as a malcontent, one with a pulpit. I don't think I was ever a bully. I tried hard not to be. But looking back, there were fights I started not only out of conviction, but also out of boredom. As I grew older, I wanted to be a regular citizen. I would always be an outsider, but that didn't bother me anymore. I wanted to come and go, to live in Clanton as I saw fit, then leave for long periods of time when I got bored. Amazing how the prospect of money can change your future. I became consumed with the dream of walking away, of taking a sabbatical to some place I'd never been, of seeing the world. The next meeting with Gary McGrew was at a restaurant in Tupelo. He'd been to my office several times. One more visit and the staff would start whispering. Over lunch, we again looked at my books, talked about his client's plans, negotiated this point and that one. If I sold, I wanted the owner to honor the new 5-year contracts I'd given to Davy Big Mouth Bass, Hardy, and Margaret. Baggy would either retire soon or die of liver poisoning. McGrew's client wanted me to stay on for at least a year, at a very high salary, and train the new editor. I would not agree to this. If I walked away, then I walked away. I didn't want a boss, and I didn't want the local heat that would come from selling the county's paper to a large firm from outside the state. Their offer was at $1.3 million. A consultant I'd hired in Knoxville had valued the Times at $1.35 million. "Confidentially, we've bought the papers in Tyler and Van Buren counties," McGrew said late in a very long lunch. "Things are falling into place." He was being almost completely honest. The owner of the paper in Tyler County had agreed in principle, but the documents had not been signed. "But there's a new wrinkle," he said. "The paper in Polk County might be for sale. Frankly, we're taking a look at it if you pass. It's quite a bit cheaper." "Ah, more pressure," I said. The Polk County Herald had 4,000 readers and lousy management. I saw it every week. "I'm not trying to pressure you," McGrew said. "I'm just putting everything on the table." "I really want $1.5 million, I said. "That's over the top, Willie." "It's high, but you'll earn it back,"
Might take a little longer, but look 10 years down the road.
Well, I'm not sure we can go that high.
You'll have to if you want the paper.
A sense of urgency had arisen. McGrew hinted at a deadline, then finally said, "We've been talking for months now, and my client is anxious to reach a conclusion. He wants to close the deal by the first of next month, or he'll go elsewhere."
The tactic didn't bother me. I was tired of talking, too. Either I sold or I didn't. It was time to make a decision.
"That's 23 days from now," I said.
"Fair enough."
The long days of summer arrived, and the insufferable heat and humidity settled in for their annual 3-month stay. I made my usual rounds, to the churches on my list, to the softball fields, to the local golf tournament, to the watermelon cuttings. But Clanton was waiting, and the wait was all we talked about. Inevitably, the noose around the neck of each remaining juror was loosened somewhat. They quite naturally got tired of being prisoners in their homes, of altering their lifelong routines, of having packs of neighbors guard their homes at night. They began to venture out, to try and resume normal lives. The patience of the killer was unnerving. He had the advantage of time, and he knew his victims would grow weary of all that protection. He knew they would drop their guard, make a mistake. We knew it, too. After missing 3 consecutive Sundays for the first time in her life, Miss Callie insisted on going to church. Escorted by Sam, Esau, and Leon, she marched into the sanctuary on Sunday morning and worshipped the Lord as if she'd been gone a year. Her brothers and sisters embraced her and prayed for her fervently. Reverend Small revised his sermon on the spot and preached on God's protection of his followers. Sam said he went on for almost 3 hours. On June 25th, in a fancy law office in Tupelo, I signed a pile of documents that transferred ownership of the Times to a media company owned in part by Mr. Ray Noble of Atlanta. Mr. Noble handed me a check for $1.5 million, and I quickly and somewhat anxiously walked it down the street where my newest friend, Stu Holland, was waiting in his rather spacious office in the Merchants Bank. News of such a deposit in Clanton would leak overnight, so I buried the money with Stu, then drove home. It was the longest 1-hour drive of my life. It was exhilarating because I had cashed in at the market's peak. I'd squeezed top dollar out of a well-heeled and honorable buyer who planned to make a few changes to my newspaper. Adventure was calling me, and now I had the means to answer. And it was a sad drive because I was giving up such a large and rewarding part of my life. The paper and I had grown and matured together, me as an adult, it as a prosperous entity. It had become what any small-town paper should be, a lively observer of current events, a recorder of history, an occasional commentator on politics and social issues. As for me, I was a young man who had blindly and doggedly built something from scratch. I suppose I should have felt my age, but all I wanted to do was find a beach, then a girl. When I returned to Clanton, I walked into Margaret's office, closed the door, and told her about the sale. She burst into tears, and before long my eyes were moist as well. Her fierce loyalty had always amazed me, and though she, like Miss Callie, worried way too much about my soul, she had grown to love me nonetheless. I explained that the new owners were wonderful people, planned no drastic changes, and had approved her new 5-year contract at an increased salary. This made her cry even more. Hardy did not cry. By then he'd been printing the Times for almost 30 years. He was moody, cantankerous, drank too much like most pressmen, and if the new owners didn't like him, then he'd simply quit and go fishing. He did appreciate the new contract, though. As did Davy Big Mouth Bass. He was shocked at the news, but rallied nicely at the idea of earning more money. Baggy was on vacation somewhere out west with his brother, not his wife. Mr. Ray Noble had been reluctant to agree to another 5 years of Baggy's sluggish reporting, and I could not in good conscience make him a part of the deal. Baggy was on his own. We had 5 other employees, and I personally broke the news to each of them. It took all of one afternoon, and when it was finally over, I was drained. I was anxious to leave town and go somewhere. But it would be impossible until the killings had stopped. For most of June, the Ruffin professors scrambled back and forth to Clanton. They juggled assignments and vacations, trying their best to make sure at least two or three of them were always with Miss Cowley. Sam seldom left the house. He stayed in Lowtown to protect his mother, but also to keep his own profile low. Trooper Durant was still around, though he was married again, and his two renegade sons had left the area. Sam spent hours on the porch, reading voraciously, playing checkers with Esau or whoever stopped by to help guard things for a while. He played backgammon with me until he figured out the strategy. Then he insisted that we bet $1 per game. Before long, I owed him $50. Such blatant gambling was a deadly secret on Miss Callie's porch. A hasty reunion was put together for the week before July 4th. Because my house had 5 empty bedrooms and a woeful lack of human activity, I insisted that it be filled with Ruffins. The family had grown considerably since I first met them in 1970. All but Sam were married, and there were 21 grandchildren. The total came to 35 Ruffins, not counting Sam, Callie, and Esau, and 34 made it to Clanton. Leon's wife had a sick father in Chicago. Of the 34, 23 moved into the Hocut house for a few days. They drifted in from different parts of the country, mostly up north, coming in shifts at all hours of the day, with each new arrival greeted with great ceremony. When Carlotta and her husband and 2 small children arrived at 3 a.m. from Los Angeles, every light in the house came on and Bobby's wife Bonnie began cooking pancakes. Bonnie took over my kitchen, and 3 times a day I was sent to the grocery store with a list of things she urgently needed. I bought ice cream by the ton, and the kids soon learned I would fetch it for them at any hour of the day. Since my porches were long and wide and seldom used, the Ruffins gravitated toward them. Sam brought Miss Callie and Esau over late in the afternoons for serious visiting. She was desperate to get out of Lowtown. Her warm little house had become a prison. At various times I heard her children talk with great concern about their mother. The obvious threat of somehow getting shot was discussed less than her health. Her blood pressure had the doctors concerned. The stress was taking its toll. Esau said she slept fitfully, something she blamed on medications. She was not as spry, didn't smile as much, and had noticeably less energy. It was all blamed on the Paget mess. As soon as he got caught and the killing stopped, then Miss Callie would bounce back. That was the optimistic view, the one generally shared by most of her children. On July 2nd, a Monday, Bonnie and company prepared a light lunch of salads and pizzas. All available Ruffins were there, and we ate on a side porch under slow-moving and practically useless wicker fans. I had yet to find the right moment to tell Miss Callie that I was leaving the paper. I knew she would be shocked and very disappointed, but I could think of no reason why we couldn't continue our Thursday lunches. The lazy post-meal chatter suddenly came to a halt. There were sirens in the distance, somewhere across town. The box was 12 inches square, 5 inches deep, white in color with red and blue stars and stripes. It was a gift package from the Bolin Pecan Farm in Hazelhurst, Mississippi, sent to Mrs. Maxine Root by her sister in Concord, California, an Independence Day gift of real American pecans. It came by mail, delivered by the postman around noon, placed in the mailbox of Maxine Root, then hauled inside, past the lone sentry sitting under a tree in the front yard, and into the kitchen where Maxine first saw it. It had been almost a month since Sheriff McNatt had quizzed her about her vote on the jury. She had reluctantly admitted that she had not been in favor of the death penalty for Danny Paget, and she recalled that the 2 men who stuck with her were Lenny Farguson and Mo Teal. Since they were now dead, McNatt had delivered the grave news that she might be the next victim. For years after the trial, Maxine had wrestled with the verdict. The town was bitter over it, and she felt the hostility. Thankfully, the jurors kept their vows of silence, and she and Lenny and Mo avoided any additional abuse. With the soothing passage of time, she had been able to distance herself from the aftermath. Now the world knew how she'd voted. Now a crazy man was stalking her. She was on leave from her job as a bookkeeper. Her nerves were shot. She couldn't sleep. She saw the box of pecans and started crying. Someone out there loved her. Her precious sister Jane was thinking about her.
Oh, how she'd love to be in California with Jane at that very moment. Maxine started to open the package, then had a thought. She went to the phone and dialed Jane's number. They had not talked in a week. Jane was at work, thrilled to hear from her. They chatted about this and that, then about the horrible situation in Clanton.
"You're a dear to send the pecans," Maxine said.
"What pecans?" Jane asked. A pause.
"The gift box from Bowling Pecans down in Hazelhurst. A big one, 3 pounds.
Another pause.
"Not me, sis. Must have been someone else."
Maxine hung up moments later and examined the box. A sticker on the front said, "A gift from Jane Parham." Of course, she knew no other Jane Parhams. Very gently, she picked it up. It seemed a bit heavy for a 3-pound tin of pecans. Travis, the part-time deputy, happened by the house. He was accompanied by one Teddy Ray, a pimple-faced boy with an oversized uniform and a service revolver that he had never fired. Maxine hustled them into the kitchen where the red, white, and blue box sat benignly on the counter. The lone sentry was also tagging along, and for a long minute or so, the four of them just stared at the package. Maxine recounted verbatim her conversation with Jane. With great hesitation, Travis picked up the box and shook it slightly.
"Seems a mite heavy for pecans," he observed.
He looked at Teddy Ray, who'd already gone pale, and at the neighbor with a rifle, who seemed ready to duck at anything.
"You think it's a bomb?" the neighbor asked.
"Oh, my God,"
Maxine mumbled and appeared ready to collapse.
"Could be," Travis said, then gawked down in horror at what he was holding.
"Get it outside," Maxine said.
"Shouldn't we call the sheriff?"
Teddy Ray managed to ask.
"I guess so," Travis said.
"What if it's got a timer or something?" asked the neighbor.
Travis hesitated for a moment, then, with the voice of absolutely no experience, said,
"I know what to do."
They stepped through the kitchen door onto a narrow porch that ran the length of the rear of the house. Travis carefully placed the box at the very edge, 3 feet or so above the ground. When he removed his .44 Magnum, Maxine said,
"What are you doing?"
"We're going to see if it's a bomb," Travis said.
Teddy Ray and the neighbor scurried off the porch and took up a safe position in the grass about 50 feet away.
"You're going to shoot my pecans?" Maxine asked.
"You got a better idea," Travis snapped back.
"I guess not." With most of his body inside the kitchen, Travis leaned out through the screen door with his thick right arm and his rather large head and took aim. Maxine was right behind him, crouching low and peeking around his waist. The first shot missed the porch entirely, though it took the breath out of Maxine. Teddy Ray shouted,
"Nice shot!"
and he and the neighbor had a quick laugh. Travis aimed and fired again. The explosion ripped the porch completely from the house, tore a gaping hole in the back wall behind the kitchen, and sprayed shrapnel for 100 yards. It shattered windows, peeled up planks, and it wounded the four observers. Teddy Ray and the neighbor both took bits of metal in their chests and legs. Travis's right arm and his firing hand were mangled. Maxine was hit twice in the head. One piece of glass ripped off the lobe of her right ear, and a small nail penetrated her right jaw. For a moment, they were all unconscious, knocked silly by 3 pounds of plastic explosives packed with nails, glass, and ball bearings. As the sirens continued to wail across town, I went to the phone and called Wiley Meek. He was just about to call me.
"They tried to blow up Maxine Root," he said.
I told the Ruffins there'd been an accident and left them on the porch. When I got near the subdivision where the Roots lived, the main roads were blocked and traffic was being turned away. I hustled over to the hospital and found a young doctor I knew. He said that there were 4 injured, none of whom appeared to be in grave danger. Judge Omar Noose was holding court in Clanton that afternoon. In fact, he later said that he heard the explosion. Rufus Buckley and Sheriff McNapp met with him for over an hour in chambers, and what they discussed was never revealed. As we waited in the courtroom, Harry Rex and most of the other lawyers loitering there were certain that they were debating how to handle an arrest warrant for Danny Padgett when there was so little proof that he'd done anything wrong.
But something had to be done. Someone had to be arrested. The sheriff had a population to protect. He had to take action, even if it wasn't entirely proper. We got a report that Travis and Teddy Ray had been transported to one of the hospitals in Memphis for surgery. Maxine and her neighbor were under the knife at that very moment. Again, it was the opinion of the doctors that no life was in jeopardy. Travis might lose his right arm, though. How many people in Ford County knew how to make package bombs? Who had access to explosives? Who had motive? As we argued these questions in the courtroom, they were evidently being argued back in chambers as well. Noose, Buckley, and McNatt were all elected officials. The good people of Ford County needed their protection. Since Danny Padgett was the only conceivable suspect, Judge Noose finally issued a warrant for his arrest. Lucian was notified, and he took the news without objection. At that moment, not even Padgett's lawyer could argue with the strategy of bringing him in for processing. He could always be released later. A few minutes after 5 p.m., a convoy of police cars blew out of Clanton and headed for Padgett Island. Harry Rex now owned a police scanner. There were quite a few new ones in town, and we sat in his office sipping beer, listening to it squawk with unchecked fury. It had to be the most exciting arrest in the history of our county, and many of us wanted to be there. Would the Padgetts block the road and thwart the arrest? Would there be gunfire? A small war? From the chatter, we were able to follow most of what was happening. At Highway 42, McNatt and his men were met by 10 units of the State Highway Patrol. We assumed a unit meant nothing more than a car, but it sounded far more serious. They proceeded to Highway 401, turned onto the county road that led to the island, and at the bridge where everyone expected some dramatic showdown, there sat Danny Padgett in the car with his lawyer. The voices on the scanner were quick and anxious.
He's with his lawyer.
Will Banks?
Yep.
Let's shoot both of them.
They're getting out of the car.
Will Banks is holding up his hands, smartass.
It's Danny Padgett, all right, hands held high. I'd like to knock that smile off his face.
They got the cuffs on him.
Damn it! Harry Rex yelled across his desk. I wanted some gunfire, just like in the old days.
Unknown to anyone, Lucian Wilbanks and Judge New struck a deal in the hectic hours before the arrest. The judge was worried about what might happen if Danny Padgett chose to retreat into the safety of the island, or worse, resist the arrest with force. The county was a powder keg waiting for a match. The cops were ready for blood because of Teddy Ray and Travis, whose gunslinging stupidity was being temporarily ignored while they recovered from their wounds. And Maxine Root came from a notoriously rough family of loggers, a large, fierce clan known to hunt year-round, live off their land, and leave no grudge unchallenged. Lucian appreciated the situation. He agreed to deliver his client on one condition. He wanted an immediate bail hearing. He had at least a dozen witnesses who were willing to provide airtight alibis for Danny, and Lucian wanted the folks in Clanton to hear their testimony. He truly believed that someone else was behind the killings, and it was important to convince the town. Lucian was also 1 month away from being disbarred in an unrelated mess. He knew the end was coming, and the bail hearing would be his last performance. Noose agreed to a hearing and set it for 10 a.m. the next day, July 3rd. In a scene eerily reminiscent of one 9 years earlier, Danny Padgett once again packed the Ford County Courthouse. It was a hostile crowd, anxious to get a look at him, hopeful that he might be strung up on the spot. As I waited and watched the courtroom fill up, I realized it was the last time I would cover such a proceeding for the Times. I found no sadness in that. I had mentally checked out, mentally spent some of the money. And now that Danny was in custody, I was even more anxious to escape Clanton and go see the world. At 10 a.m., all seats were filled and a thick row of spectators lined the walls. 15 minutes later, there was a shuffle behind the bench. A door opened, and Lucian Wilbanks emerged. Two bailiffs quickly followed him, and one announced, "All rise for the court!" Judge Noose ambled forth in his black robe and sat on his throne.
"Please be seated," he said into the microphone. He surveyed the crowd and seemed astonished at the number of us out there.
He nodded, the side door opened, and Danny Paget, handcuffed, shackled at the ankles, and sporting the orange jail jumpsuit he'd worn before, was let in by three deputies. It took a few minutes to unlock him from his various restraints, and when he was finally free, he leaned over and whispered something to Lucian.
"This is a bail hearing,"
Noose announced, and the courtroom was still and quiet.
"There's no reason why it cannot be handled judiciously and briefly."
It would be much briefer than anyone anticipated. A cannon exploded somewhere above us, and for a split second I thought we'd all been shot. Something cracked sharply through the heavy air of the courtroom, and for a town so jittery to begin with, we all froze in one horrible snapshot of disbelief. Then Danny Paget grunted in a delayed reaction, and all hell broke loose. Women screamed, men screamed. Someone yelled, "Get down!" as half the spectators ducked low, some hitting the floor. Someone shouted, "He's been shot!" I lowered my head a few inches, but I didn't want to miss anything. Every deputy yanked out a service revolver and looked in a different direction for someone to shoot. They pointed up and down, front and back, here and there. Though we argued about it for years, the second shot was no more than 3 seconds behind the first. It hit Danny in the ribs, but it had not been necessary. The first had gone through his head. The second shot drew the attention of a deputy in the front of the courtroom. I was ducking even lower, but I saw him pointing to the balcony. The double doors to the courtroom flew open and the stampede was on. In the hysteria that followed, I stayed in my seat and tried to take in everything. I remember seeing Lucian Wilbanks hovering over his client, and Rufus Buckley on his hands and knees scurrying in front of the jury box in an effort to escape. And I'll never forget Judge Noose, sitting calmly at the bench, reading glasses perched on the tip of his nose, watching the chaos as if he saw it every week. Each second seemed to last a minute. The shots that hit Danny were fired from the ceiling above the balcony. And though the balcony was filled with people, no one saw the rifle drop down a few inches 10 feet above their heads. Like the rest of us, they were preoccupied with getting a first glance at Danny Paget. The county had patched and renovated the courtroom at various times over the decades, whenever a few spare bucks could be squeezed from the coffers. Back in the late 60s, in an effort to improve the lighting, a drop ceiling had been installed. The sniper found the perfect spot on a heating duct just above a panel in the ceiling. There in the dark crawl space, he waited patiently, watching the courtroom below through a 5-inch slit he'd created by lifting one of the water-stained panels. Suddenly there was more gunfire. Thankfully, now it was outside. I looked out a courtroom window and saw people scampering into the stores around the square. I saw an old man point upward, sort of above my head, to something on the top of the courthouse. Sheriff McNatt had just found the crawl space when he heard shots above him. He and two deputies climbed the stairs to the third floor, then slowly took the cramped circular stairway through the dome. The door to the cupola was jammed shut, but just above it they could hear the anxious footsteps of the sniper, and they could hear shell casings hit the floor. After holding the town hostage for an hour, the sniper ran out of ammunition. He saved the last bullet for himself, and when he pulled the trigger he fell hard on the small passage door in the floor of the cupola. Sheriff McNatt waited a few minutes, then managed to shove the door up and open. The body of Hank Hooten was naked again, and as dead as fresh roadkill. A deputy ran down the stairs and yelled, "It's over! He's dead! It's Hank Hooten!" Eventually, an ambulance carrying Danny Paget pulled away from the courthouse and left in no hurry whatsoever. The removal of Hank Hooten was a bit more demanding. But with time, they wrestled down his corpse, then rolled it out of the courthouse on a gurney, covered from head to toe with a white sheet. I walked to my office, where Margaret and Wiley were sipping fresh coffee and waiting for me. We were too stunned to engage in intelligent conversation. The entire town was muted. I eventually made some phone calls, found who I wanted, and around noon left the office. The state mental hospital was 20 miles east of Jackson on an interstate highway. I bluffed my way through the guardhouse using the name of a doctor I'd located fishing around with the phone. Dr. Vero was very busy, and I read magazines for an hour outside his office.
When I informed the girl at the desk that I was not leaving and that I would follow him home if necessary, he somehow found the time to squeeze me in. Vero had long hair and a grayish beard. His accent was clearly upper Midwest. Two diplomas on his wall tracked him through Northwestern and Johns Hopkins, though in the dingy light of his debris-strewn office I couldn't read the details. I told him what had happened that morning in Clanton. After my narrative, he said, "This is what you can print. Mr. Hooten was admitted here in January 1971. He was diagnosed as schizophrenic, confined here, treated here, and released in October 1976. "Who diagnosed him?" I asked. "We now go off the record, agreed?" "Agreed." He relaxed a little and said, "I treated Mr. Hooten initially. His family had a history of schizophrenia. His mother and possibly his grandmother suffered from it. He was institutionalized while he was in college and remarkably managed to finish law school. After his second divorce, he moved to Clanton in the mid-60s, looking for a place to start over. Another divorce followed. He adored women but could not survive in a relationship. He was quite enamored with Rhoda Castlelaw and claimed he asked her to marry him repeatedly. I'm sure the young lady was somewhat wary of him. Her murder was very traumatic, and when the jury refused to send her killer to death, he, shall I say, slipped over the edge." "Did he mention the jurors?" I asked. "Oh, yes, all the time. He knew that three of them, Mr. Farguson, Mr. Teal, and Mrs. Root, had refused to bring back a death penalty. He would scream their names in the middle of the night." "That's amazing," I said. "The jurors vowed to never discuss their deliberations. We didn't know how they voted until a month ago." "Well, he was the assistant prosecutor." "Yes, he was. I vividly remembered Hank Hooten sitting beside Ernie Gaddis at the trial, never saying a word, looking bored and detached from the proceedings." "Did he express a desire to seek revenge?" I asked. A sip of coffee, another pause as he debated whether to answer. "Yes. He hated them. He wanted them dead along with Mr. Paget." "Then why was he released?" "I can't talk about his release, Mr. Traynor. I wasn't here at the time, and there might be some liability on the part of this institution."
"You weren't here?"
"I left for 2 years to teach in Chicago. When I returned 18 months ago, Mr. Hooten was gone."
"But you've reviewed his file."
"Yes, and his condition improved dramatically while I was away. The doctors found the right mix of antipsychotic drugs, and his symptoms diminished substantially. He was released to a community treatment program in Tupelo, and from there he sort of fell off our radar. Needless to say, Mr. Traynor, the treatment of the mentally ill is not a priority in this state, nor in many others. We are grossly understaffed and underfunded. I thank Dr. Vero for his time, for his candor, and promise to protect his confidence. He asked for a copy of whatever I printed." I stopped at a fast food place in Jackson for a cheeseburger. At a payphone, I called the office, half wondering if I'd missed more shootings. Margaret was relieved to hear my voice.
"You must come home, Willie, and quickly," she said.
"Why?"
"Callie Ruffin has had a stroke. She's in the hospital."
A county bond issue in 1977 had paid for a handsome renovation to our hospital. At one end of the main floor there was a modern, though quite dark, chapel where I'd once sat with Margaret and her family as her mother passed away. It was there that I found the Ruffins, all 8 children, all 21 grandchildren, and every spouse but Leon's wife. Reverend Thurston Small was there, along with a sizable contingent from the church. Esau was upstairs in the intensive care unit waiting outside Miss Callie's room. Sam told me that she had awakened from a nap with a sharp pain in her left arm, then numbness in her leg, and before long she was mumbling incoherently. An ambulance rushed her to the hospital. The doctor was certain it was initially a stroke, one that precipitated a mild heart attack. She was being heavily medicated and monitored. The last report from the doctor had been around 8 p.m. Her condition was described as serious but stable. Visitors were not allowed, so there was little to do but wait and pray and greet friends as they came and went. After an hour in the chapel, I was ready for bed.
Max, third in the birth order but the undeniable leader, organized a schedule for the night. At least two of Miss Callie's children would be somewhere in the hospital at all times. We checked with the doctor again around 11, and he sounded reasonably optimistic that she was still stable. She was asleep, as he put it, but upon further questioning admitted that they had her knocked out to prevent another stroke. "Go home and rest," he said. "Tomorrow could be a long day." We left Mario and Gloria in the chapel and moved en masse to the Hocut house, where we ate ice cream on a side porch. Sam had taken Esau home to Lowtown. I was delighted that the rest of the family preferred staying at my place. Of the 13 adults there, only Leon and Carlotta's husband Sterling would touch alcohol. I opened a bottle of wine, and the three of us passed on the ice cream. Everyone was exhausted, especially the children. I eventually slept for 2 hours, then eased downstairs where I found Mario and Leon drinking coffee at the kitchen table. Mario had left the hospital an hour earlier. There'd been no change. A few hours later, I began the chore of boxing up the things and junk I'd collected in 9 years and cleaning out my office. My emotions were mixed. Everything I touched brought back a story, a deadline, a trip deep into the county to chase a lead, interview a witness, or meet someone I hoped would be interesting enough for a profile. Bobby Ruffin called at 9:30. Miss Callie was awake, sitting up, sipping some tea, and they were allowing visitors for a few minutes. I hurried to the hospital. Sam met me in the hall and led me through the maze of rooms and cubicles in ICU. She was awake, but barely. I had expected to see the bright eyes and brilliant smile, but Miss Callie was barely conscious. She recognized me. We hugged. I patted her right hand. The left one had an IV. Sam, Esau, and Gloria were in the room. I wanted a few minutes alone so I could finally tell her I was selling the paper, but she was in no condition for such news. She'd been awake for almost 2 hours, and she obviously needed more sleep. Perhaps in a day or so we could have a lively chat about it. After 15 minutes, the doctor showed up and asked us to leave. We left, we came back, and the vigil continued throughout the 4th of July, though we were not allowed inside the ICU again. The mayor decided there would be no fireworks for the 4th. We'd heard enough explosions, suffered enough from gunpowder. Given the town's lingering jumpiness, there was no organized objection. The bands marched, the parade went on, the political speeches were the same as before. There was ice cream, lemonade, barbecue, cotton candy, the usual food and snacks on the courthouse lawn. But the town was subdued. Or maybe it was just me. Maybe I was just so tired of the place that nothing seemed right about it. I certainly had the remedy. After the speeches, I left the square and drove back to the hospital. In the waiting room on the second floor, I found Bobby with Al's wife. They were watching television like two zombies. I had just opened a magazine when Sam came running in. "She's had another heart attack," he said. The three of us jumped to our feet as if we had somewhere to go. "It just happened. They got the red team in there." "I'll call the house," I said, and stepped to the payphone in the hall. Max answered the phone, and 15 minutes later the Ruffins were streaming into the chapel. The doctors took forever before giving us an update. It was almost 8 p.m. before her treating physician entered the chapel. Doctors are notoriously hard to read, but his heavy eyes and wrinkled brow conveyed an unmistakable message. As he described a significant cardiac arrest, the 8 children of Miss Callie deflated as a group. She was on a respirator, no longer able to breathe by herself. Within an hour, the chapel was full of her friends. Reverend Thurston Small led a nonstop prayer group near the altar, and people joined it and left it as they wished. Poor Esau sat on the back row, slumped over, thoroughly drained. His grandchildren surrounded him, all very quiet and respectful. For hours we waited, and though we tried to smile and be optimistic, there was a feeling of doom. It was as if the funeral had already begun. By midnight we were numb and rapidly losing track of time. Minutes dragged by. Then I would look at the clock on the wall and wonder where the past hour went. I wanted to leave, if only to walk outside and breathe fresh air. The doctor, however, had warned us to stay close.
The horror of the ordeal hit when he gathered us around and gravely said it was time for a final moment with the family. There were gasps, then tears. I'll never forget hearing Sam say out loud, "A final moment? This is it?" Gloria asked in absolute terror. Frightened and bewildered, we followed the doctor out of the chapel, down the hall, up a flight of stairs, all of us moving with the heavy feet of someone marching to his own execution. The nurses helped herd us through the maze in ICU, their faces telling us what we dreaded the most. As the family filed into the cramped little room, the doctor touched my arm and said, "This should be just for the family." "Right," I said, stopping. "It's okay," Sam said. "He's with us." We packed around Miss Callie and her machines, most of which had been disconnected. The two smallest grandchildren were placed at the foot of her bed. Esau stood closest to her, gently patting her face. Her eyes were closed. She did not appear to be breathing. She was very much at peace. Her husband and children touched some part of her, and the crying was heartbreaking. I was in a corner, wedged behind Gloria's husband and Al's wife, and I simply could not believe where I was or what I was doing. When Max got his emotions under control, he touched Miss Callie's arm and said, "Let us pray." We bowed our heads, and most of the crying stopped, for a moment anyway. "Dear Lord, not our will but yours. Into thine hands we commend the spirit of this faithful child of God. Prepare a place for her now in your heavenly kingdom. Amen." At sunrise, I was sitting on the porch outside my office. I wanted to be alone, to have a good cry in private. The crying around my house was more than I could bear. As I had dreamed of traveling the world, I had the recurring vision of returning to Clanton with gifts for Miss Callie. I'd bring her a silver vase from England, linens from Italy she would never see, perfumes from Paris, chocolates from Belgium, an urn from Egypt, a small diamond from the mines of South Africa. I would present these to her on her porch before we had lunch. Then we would talk about the places they came from. I would send her postcards at every stop. We would review my photographs in great detail. Through me, she would vicariously see the world. She would always be there, waiting eagerly for my return, anxious to see what I'd brought her. She would fill her home with little pieces of the world and own things that no one, black or white, had ever owned in Clanton. I ached with the loss of my dear friend. Its suddenness was cruel, as it always is. Its depth was so immense that I could not at that time imagine a recovery. As the town slowly came to life below me, I walked to my desk, shoved some boxes out of the way, and sat down. I took my pen and for a long time stared at a blank notepad. Eventually, slowly, with great agony, I began the last obituary. This is Terrence Mann. We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Last Juror by John Grisham. This program was produced and directed by David Rapkin. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Abridgment by Peter Michaelos. Script supervision by Kathleen Hale. Text copyright 2004 by Belfry Holdings, Inc. Production copyright 2004, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.